continue to serve, continue to do that at a high level. And as John Lee Johnson used to say, our predecessor here, stay out of trouble. But as Paul Muth likes to say, and I agree, get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you.
Okay. Is it my memory or is it just everything runs together? Is this two in a row for you?
No.
Were you here last week?
No, we were not.
Oh, okay. Like I said, everything runs together. I'm going to kick it with Mumia as usual. I haven't heard this commentary. He's got a number of commentaries up, and there's a commentary about him from his very famous woman activist, the woman that got his first book into print, actually. I'm forgetting her name right now, but you can go to prisonradio.com, or is it .org? Prison Radio, it'll come up, to find his commentaries, and a lot of others. I haven't been playing them, but there's a very spirited upwelling of commentaries from all over these. A lot of folks doing commentaries from the prison, where a lot of them are on effective solitary because of COVID. What do I got today? We've got some Greg Palast election theft report, and that's been a weekly feature. Played it through the last election cycle. Dennis Bernstein of Flashpoints is doing that again. I believe it was recorded on Thursday. That may be sort of a regular day, preempting things. Got something from Sonali Kalhatar, producer out of KPFK in L.A. She's got a retired, quit under protest journalist talking about the IG reports. I don't know if you've seen the news, but there was another IG relieved of duty. That's Inspector General. This one was looking over the Transportation Department, which you would think would be not too controversial. But since Mitch McConnell's wife is Transportation Secretary for the Trump phenomenon, and her family, which is Chinese, I don't want to stoke any xenophobia, but her family is a wealthy shipping magnate family. They have lots of ships and other media of transportation. So it's kind of an eyebrow raiser for her to be given that position to start with. And the Inspector General for the Transportation Department was apparently looking into possible contract malfeasance. So they had to go. But anyway, I'm going to kick it. Amy Goodman's got a commentary. Haven't heard that yet. Stay in and organize. So I need to upgrade my devices, I think. They're about 10 years out of date. As long as they do what you need them to do, I guess it's okay. All right, here's Mumia Abu-Jamal, and then we'll get to Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier essay. Probably go right to Greg Palast. Okay. The piece from Jeremy Scahill in The Intercepted is probably getting us close to home in a way, because we do have a major meatpacking plant in Rantoul. Might be where the vector for transmission. I just saw something from the New York Times. I haven't found it originally, but it was circulated by a couple of people on my Facebook feed, including Daniel Chenoweth, that shows that Champaign-Urbana has the fourth highest replacement rate, new case rate, basically, something like that. And then it's a bunch of small communities that either have a prison or a meatpacking place by them, I think. What the vectors of transmission are. But I'm not that's it. And I can't play one on the radio because I can't even say it. All right, here's Mumia. Well, okay, well, these jacks don't want to fit together.
Vulnerable, the United States, and indeed nations around the world, is
to something that the human eye cannot see. In a matter of days, the world's most aggressive economy crumbled like crackers. And within weeks, a few dozen coronavirus cases exploded to well over a million. While in 2 months, over 87,000 people lost their lives, from infants to the elderly. To say that the U.S. was ill-equipped to handle this virus is understatement. The medical system was overwhelmed. The political system was outmatched, and most other systems simply shut their doors, went home, and battened down the hatches as if waiting for a great storm. But what kind of storm is silent and unseen? Apparently, a viral one. Are vaccines the solution? Apparently not. For the best vaccines claim about 40% efficacy, which means, of course, that 60% of the vaccinated population find that it isn't effective. And who really believes that the government can or will vaccinate over 300 million people? The government that can't find the people it promised to give money to will vaccinate over 300 million people? I mean, who believes that? If this were, as claimed, an America First government, what would an American Last government look like? And how can there be an America First policy when Americans come in dead last? In a few days, 100,000 Americans, men, women, and children, will be dead, with a level of sheer incompetence that is frankly stunning. The nation is marching headlong into the abyss. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Well, I agree with his general assessment there, but I think that figure on vaccine effectiveness is lumps all vaccines together. For some diseases, some vaccines are much more effective than 40%. But just knowing what I've heard about coronavirus and its mutability and how many different variations there are, possibly, that it might not be, well, there's... Yeah, might not be the most effective one. It may have something like... I've been thinking that they should probably put out three or five, more than three, the usual three flu vaccines. Maybe they ought to double it to six so to protect people. Because if you're getting the flu with COVID, which is going to happen this fall, it'd be good to have some of those strains knocked out of the system. And that's why you get the flu and you... After you had the vaccination, people say, well, it didn't work. Well, if you hadn't had the vaccine, you might have had a much worse case and possibly even a lethal one. So I have no brief for Big Pharma. I hate them more than anti-vaxxers do, but you don't throw everything away because a corporation has taken over the system. Here's Amy Goodman's commentary.
Stay at home, stay alive, organize, organize. I am Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. We're between two historical epochs now, BC and AC, before COVID-19 and after COVID-19. Established institutions, entrenched regimes, and powerful corporations are well positioned to navigate the uncharted waters of this in-between, DC or during COVID-19 time. Less equipped are the poor and working class, unable to gather safely to protest, to rally for better conditions. The novel coronavirus has amplified the gross inequality that dominates our society. Just look at the disconnect between the stock market and the plight of workers. It seems with every announcement of historic job losses, the Dow Jones and the S&P 500 shoot upward. On Wall Street, they're counting gains, while on Main Street, they're digging graves.
These are hard times.
That's Reverend William Barber II. He was speaking Wednesday on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
A lot of the pain is by choice. It didn't have to be. It's not because of the virus, per se. It is because of the pandemic of greed and lies and trickle-down economics that in this situation caused us to move in the wrong direction from the beginning. Even before COVID hit, too many people were in power were too comfortable with other people's deaths. We had 140 million poor, low-income people in this country, 43% of the nation, 700 people dying a day from poverty and low wealth, 250,000 a year, even before COVID hit.
Reverend Barber is co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign and president of the nonprofit Repairers of the Breach. He and campaign co-chair Reverend Liz Thea Harris of the Union Theological Seminary are calling on people from all walks of life to join a digital online mass poor people's assembly and moral march on Washington on June 20th at june2020.org.
Don't you believe these lies these governors are telling us and about the time to open back up the society? Stay at home, stay alive, organize.
Despite the incredible challenges, despite the demands to stay at home for those fortunate enough to stay at home, people are organizing and taking creative and courageous action. As has been the case throughout U.S. history, movements drive change. Now is no exception. Shortly after his interview on Democracy Now!, Barber spoke at a virtual mass action, a nationwide strike staged by workers at McDonald's restaurants. Fast food workers there and at other restaurant chains have been organizing the Fight for 15 campaign for a living wage for years. That's $15 an hour. One worker after another spoke on the live video stream detailing the challenges and risks they face daily as part of our sprawling, underpaid, and virtually ignored essential workforce.
And I'm a McDonald's worker here in Kansas City, Missouri.
That's Fred Marion.
And I'm going on strike because as you see me and listen to me, I am human just like you. I may not be a doctor or a paramedic, but I'm out here on the front lines just like them, and I'm human just like them. We deserve PPE, hazard pay, health care. $15 is just a living wage, and it's even the proper living wage for us. I just deserve to be treated like a human, and that's why I'm going on strike.
Angelica Hernandez spoke in Spanish.
Hey, pues la verdad. McDonald's.
Inspired to strike by her coworker who was stricken by COVID-19 and is currently on a ventilator. McDonald's, she said, showed no interest in providing protective gear for workers. Katara Wilkins added,
people can get it, anybody can get it, so I think it's kind of dangerous, and we're risking our lives to work for 7-25.
In solidarity with striking workers were speakers like Mary Kay Henry, international president of SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, and epidemiologist David Michaels, who served as head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration under President Obama. New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand spoke, pointing out that
even after Congress passed an emergency paid sick leave law in March, 75% of workers were left out thanks to carve-outs for big businesses like McDonald's. If they or a loved one get sick, they have to face an impossible choice between their family's economic security and its health. That is not a choice that any of us should be forced to make. It's a failure in policy. If you can't afford to stay home when you're sick, that's a problem for you and everyone you come in contact with when you're at work. Making sure everyone can afford to stay home when they are their most contagious is crucial to combating this virus.
Meanwhile, in front of McDonald's corporate headquarters in Chicago, activists installed a symbolic picket line of sign-holding, cardboard silhouettes of striking workers. The ACLU drove an electronic billboard truck through the streets of downtown Chicago, broadcasting the workers' demand for a living wage. These are difficult, dangerous times. Armed, overwhelmingly white, right-wing vigilantes storm state capitals, while the undocumented, the poor, communities of color, those most at risk keep our economy moving, growing our food, working in slaughterhouses, and and warehouses, delivering packages and meals, cleaning our hospitals, and caring for our elderly. They face COVID-19 infection on a daily basis with practically no safety net. Whatever future we collectively forge in the after COVID-19 era, the needs of these essential workers and of the poor must be front and center. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, Reverend Barber, that would be a good thing to link into. There's a webinar about well, maybe I'll have that later this show or tomorrow's show, but it's about what communities are doing with COVID and undocumented and immigrant workers, both. And it's coming up after the three-day weekend. What does a three-day weekend mean? I don't know. But then I was retired anyway. So, all right, enough of this. Let's hear the election theft report from Dennis Bernstein and Flashpoints, the Thursday edition. We'll get right to it, as I want to get a fair amount of this other material on about the Inspector General. There's been another sacking, if you didn't hear me say that. Transportation IG department, and it hits our great senator, majority leader in the Senate, where he lives, or it should. Broader thing is that there's this group called Groundswell that the wife of Clarence Thomas, who had this fawning 2-hour special on PBS this week. It's kind of curious. And she, Ginny, his wife, was featured doing continuity. It was really awful. I could only watch small parts of it. So, but she works with a group called Groundswell that is trying to ensure that the unitary executive is implemented, and they have a brief against inspector generals as being an inappropriate. So there may be something other than careening from one scandal to the other. I don't know if there's a broader thing going on here. Here's the Flashpoints thing. Election theft report, we'll be calling it, I guess.
Now, the virus that we're talking about having to do, you know, a lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat. But we have it so well under control. It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
Now the Democrats are politicizing the coronavirus. And this is their new hoax.
Well, I think treatment in many ways might be more exciting.
You know, we have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that get better just by, you know, sitting around and even going to work. Some of them go to work, but they get better.
You are an idiot. Oh, 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 oh.
I just got a studio. Just
yeah, they get better. You're listening to another edition of the Election Crimes Bulletin. I'm Dennis Bernstein. We are joined weekly by muckraking reporter Greg Palast. Well, he is again on the front lines protecting your vote. He's got an upcoming book, which is worth checking out if you're interested in trying to protect your vote. We'll be out soon, How Trump Stole 2020. It's really about how to prevent him from stealing it. And that's what this Crimes Bulletin is all about. Greg, welcome back. There's been some activity in Texas. There's been a battle going on in Michigan, and the battle for the vote and our lives really continues.
Yes, a lot of skullduggery, and my book is called How Trump Stole 2020, but we can steal it back. That is, we can bust the crime. And it's not about what you're for against Trump. I'm just hoping that this time, unlike 2016, the voters will actually choose the president. That would be refreshing.
That would be nice.
Yes.
So Texas, there was a bit of a victory. They went for the juggler, but they got beaten back. What happened?
Yeah. I hope you were enjoying the victory of democracy for the several hours we had it. A federal judge, ruled that Texas requirement, the hoops you have to jump through in order to vote absentee in Texas, had to be swept away because it said you have to claim a disability in Texas or be over 65 are the main reasons that you can get an absentee ballot. And you have to certify that you have this disability. And so the judge said, well, if you are susceptible and worried about being susceptible to the virus, that's a physical disability. And so anyone that claims concern because they're susceptible or vulnerable, if they have a virus, should be able to get an absentee ballot. It was, and in addition, by the way, the idea that you can be 65 and ask for, you get that ballot, is a direct violation of the 26th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. If you remember, during the war in Vietnam, we lowered the voting age to 18. That amendment to the Constitution also said that there could be no discrimination by age in voting, as long as someone's 18 or more. And so saying that young people, sometimes we refer to them as Democrats, that if young people want an absentee ballot, they're out of luck because of their age. Direct violation of the Constitution. But hey, while the judge caught this, within about 2 days, you ended up with the appeals court in Texas, the federal appeals court in that circuit, setting aside the judge's ruling. And Dennis, I rarely read something over the air, but I got to read you from Judge Fred Byerie's statement on why. He said that you can get a vote, that you don't have to die to vote in Texas, even though he was overruled. He wrote 240 years on, Americans now, after our independence, Americans now seek life without fear of pandemic, liberty to choose their leaders in an environment free of disease, and the pursuit of happiness without undue restrictions. There are some among us who would, if they could, nullify those aspirational ideas to return to the not-so-halcyon and not-so-thrilling days of yesteryear of the divine right of kings, trading our birthright as a sovereign people for a modern mess of governing pottage in the hands of a few and forfeiting the vision of America as a shining city upon a hill. No wonder they slapped him down.
Yeah.
That's a story in Texas. So in other words, in Texas, God, if you want to have to avoid the standing in line and getting infected, I advise you to cut off part of your leg or age very rapidly. So that's the story in Texas. And, you know, let's not forget, you know, this is not the only problem with Texas. You know, we're forgetting all the other things that happened in which this maximizes the problem. As you saw, you remember, you've mentioned many times that that the forced election in Wisconsin in March resulted in the collapse of the number of voting stations in the African-American majority city of Milwaukee from 180 polling stations to 5. Well, I got to tell you, Texas started long before there was a virus. In the 50 counties with rising black and Latino populations in Texas, the average county gave up more than 10 polling stations in each of those counties with rising black and Hispanic populations. Whereas in the 50 counties where the white population grew, they lost less than one precinct per county for voting. So in other words, let's not forget all the other racial games and games against young people that are being played in these states. So, you know, so Texas has a long history.
All right. You're listening to the Election Crimes Bulletin. I want to, again, swerve back to Wisconsin. By the way, it's 70 and counting in terms of people who are saying they got sick as a result of being forced to vote in this sort of in the middle of the flare-up of the pandemic in that state. So that's sort of having to really put your life on the line to vote.
Yes.
Let's fast forward. Trump is in Michigan today. There's a flood going on there. Trump acting as usual like a moronic child, refusing to wear a mask, jeopardizing other people. But the battle is about the vote, about mail-in votes, and we have to talk, Greg, about mail-in votes because there's a lot of confusion and people need to understand what is really the story, what is the problem, and what is the possibility.
Well, okay, a few things. In Wisconsin, by the way, I'm continuing my investigation. People thought that there's a great public victory because the right-wing justice was removed from the court and the progressive won election. But here's the bad news. The right-wing still has a majority on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, and the guy who lost is insisting that he will not give up his seat, and he's unrecused himself, which I've never heard of in a courtroom from my own legal experience. He's unrecused himself, saying that he has now the right, since he's not on a ballot anymore, he lost, he has the right to rule on whether 232,000 Wisconsin voters should be removed from the voter rolls based on a bogus list that the GOP-controlled legislature is demanding that the Elections Board remove these 232,000 people. This will now go before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. This list is so bogus. My team is going through these names. I got to tell you, I can't give you the final result yet because I have to keep that embargoed, but this list is phony as a $3 bill. There are three Democrats and three Republicans on the Wisconsin Election Board. All six are saying this list is bogus. We don't want to remove these voters. But the Republican legislature is saying we don't care if these are legal voters. We want them gone because it's 2-1 Democrats. That's what's going on in Wisconsin. And then we move, and now in Michigan we have also, on top of everything else, the governor, the Democratic governor, Whitmer, has ordered that not every citizen get a ballot, but every citizen get a card asking them if they would like a mail-in ballot. And, of course, Trump has lit his comb over on fire over this, over giving people, just simply asking if they want the opportunity to vote by mail. And a lot of states are moving in this direction. But obviously, in other swing states, we have some other big problems, Georgia, Indiana, Arkansas, Ohio. There's some real problems. And as we get into the massive expansion of vote by mail, I keep warning people, I'm not, and I want people to understand, Greg Palast is not against voting by mail. We may have to do that, or, you know, we either vote by mail or we die if this pandemic comes back in fall, as experts expect. The problem is, and I want everyone to know, understand this number, 22%, more than 1 in 5 mail-in ballots never get counted. So while we move to mail-in voting, we better make sure that we know how to do it and protect our vote. And it is overwhelmingly young people and voters of color and people that use non-English language ballots especially just see their ballots, 1 in 5 ballots thrown in the garbage. That's on average. But if you're young, black, and if you use a non-English language ballot, it's something like 1,200% higher chance that your vote will never get counted than if you are white using an English language ballot and are a bit older. That's just the truth.
You know, Greg, we're speaking with Greg Palast. This is the Election Crimes Bulletin, and we're talking about how to protect your election. I know you don't want to live through another 4 years. Many of you don't anyway want to live through another 4 years. If you can live through another 4 years of Donald Trump, maybe you do. Maybe he's your hero. But in any event, the election is at stake. Greg, I never have really seriously had this conversation on the air, but there are so many loopholes and ways to undermine the vote that could create a chaos that could allow him to steal an election, right? He can steal, he can postpone, he could undermine, he could throw this into the House. So many things could happen if he manages to churn it up a little bit.
Okay, there's some real dangers here. Number one, let's play the game out to the end. This man is, our president is saying that there's massive fraud in mail-in voting. And you know, the experts like Lorraine Minniti, who's the nation's expert at Rutgers University on vote fraud. I actually did a calculation that's really true, that you are 5 times more likely to be hit by lightning than to cast a fraudulent ballot. It just doesn't happen. But by saying fraud, 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 look out. The end game may be very serious, which is under the Constitution, if states cannot certify their results, okay, so that their electors cannot go to vote in the Electoral College. And we had this in the Andrew Jackson, John Quincy Adams race, in which Jackson actually won the majority of the Electoral College. He won a majority of the popular votes. You'd think that he would have been elected president. Not in 1824, because some states didn't certify their electors. It went to the House of Representatives. If you don't have a majority in the Electoral College, it goes to the House of Representatives. Each state gets one vote. California, New York, Illinois, forget the electoral votes. They get the same single vote as South Dakota and Wyoming and Mississippi. So if it goes to the House of Representatives, this election, because some states are simply refusing to certify their votes. This could be a good trick, saying there's too much fraud in the mail-in voting, too much confusion, too many things, you know, the system's collapsed. You vote by state, and then Trump is, you know, as good as reelected. So that is that's a real and present danger with this screaming about fraud. It's setting up to disqualify electors, having Republican legislatures refusing to certify the victors in their states, and therefore throwing the election to the House. Don't discount that.
Greg Palast with a cautionary note, and they do a fair amount of pitching for the pledge drive in this next section, and they actually add on another section. That's the election crimes report, according to Dennis Bernstein. I've heard it called various things, and I'll be running it. Some great stuff. That's from the Thursday Flashpoints, flashpoints.net, or go to the WEFT or the KPFA archive and find it. Going to go to KPFK straight away. We had a little discussion about voting and mail-in voting, and I don't know if there was a lot of other things in it, but it was a totally party line vote in the State House. This is from Rise Up, and Rise Up with Sonali Kalhatar. It's a show out of, as I said, KPFK, going down to the left coast for this one. And it's a little dry, and this woman is now with this outfit that Andrew Bacevich had something going. I was pretty promised by it, but they don't even call it diplomacy. They call it statecraft. That always bothers me. Why can't we just have diplomacy and statecraft? Statecraft includes the use of force and threats of force, whereas diplomacy is supposed to be actually just talking to people and trying to resolve problems that way. Oh, well.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The State Department's new acting inspector general is also its head of the Office of Foreign Missions. Stephen Achard, who is a Senate-approved political appointee, was picked to replace the recently fired State Department inspector general Steve Linick. But by retaining his other post at the department, Achard is now effectively overseeing himself. And that appears to be the pattern within the Trump administration, which has in just 6 weeks purged four inspectors general. Mr. Linick's removal, which is the latest instance, appears to be the direct result of his inquiry into State Secretary Mike Pompeo's potential abuses of power. What does such a pattern of actions mean for the federal government? Helping me to answer that question is Elizabeth Shackelford. She is a fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of The Dissent Channel, American Diplomacy in a Dishonest Age. She was a U.S. diplomat until December 2017, when she resigned in protest of the Trump administration. She served in Somalia, South Sudan, Poland, and Washington, D.C., and she recently wrote an article titled Trump's Inspector General Purge and the Death of Dissent. Welcome to the program, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
So first explain, you know, to the lay audience what the role of an inspector general is. I understand that every major government agency has an inspector general, right?
Correct. The role of the inspector general is essentially to have an independent level of oversight over what's happening within an agency. So that is oversight over things like corrupt acts and actions and bad acts, but also over, you know, abuse, fraud, and anything such as simple oversight into, you know, security issues. So for the State Department, for example, the inspector general's office inspects all of our embassies and consulates around the world for how they're operating and also safety matters. So it covers a broad range of concerns.
So essentially, it's a watchdog position that's not meant to be part of the staff. It's basically a watchdog that's meant to make sure that leaders within the agency and staff within the agency follow the right protocol. There's no ethical violations, no conflicts of interest, et cetera, right?
Correct.
So Trump has fired four inspectors general, as you point out, in 6 weeks. How common is it for presidents to just fire an inspector general?
It's very uncommon because it tends to look like guilty behavior when that happens. Now, the president is well within his powers to do so, but the reason that they have this 30-day period of notification to Congress, which is what happened on, let's say, this, you know, the Friday night when Linick was informed that he'd be removed, that was the notification given to Congress that he was going to be removed. And the idea is, yes, the president can remove him, but Congress needs to have an opportunity to ask why.
So the firing of Linick, was that done properly? I mean, did Congress get that 30-day period of time to act?
The notification was done properly, but as has happened in some of these other scenarios, the agency seems to be forging ahead with having other, you know, acting inspectors general and put in place. So there's not really, while that notification period is there, it's not as though Linick's being given the opportunity to serve out the remaining 30 days. It seems to be a fait accompli that the administration is just assuming that they're going to get away with having him removed. Congress continues to ask questions, but whether or not that's actually going to lead to anything at the end of the day is the real question.
And who is meant to appoint an inspector general? What's the procedure? Is this a Senate-appointed position or something that the president gets to do?
The president gets to appoint the inspectors general, and, you know, they're subject to Senate approval. But they tend to be more apolitical. You know, most of these inspectors general had been appointed by prior presidents. In this case, it was President Obama. But this isn't one of those positions that you expect with a change in administration to have a big turnover, because their position is not supposed to be a political one at all. In fact, in most cases, it's a pretty dull position. I mean, you're looking at things like, you know, are the wall thicknesses and the construction protocols for embassies overseas, you know, checking the right boxes for, you know, what our standards are. Most of it's not political issues. But in this case, it is, which is why the idea of the only safeguard being, well, you give 30 days of notice to Congress, that's proving in this case not to be sufficient.
So how unusual is it for now the person who's replaced Linick, the acting inspector general, to continue to hold his position within the State Department?
It makes absolutely no sense. I mean, you can't be placed in charge of overseeing your own activities. Well, you can, and we see that seems to be a preference for the Trump administration, but it certainly defeats the purpose of having that position.
He's essentially the fox, you know, examining the hen house.
Exactly. One might say a little similar to having private industries put in charge of regulating themselves, as opposed to having independent agencies do it. It's not that it's necessarily nefarious. It's just that, you know, who is somebody going to report to if they're going to report, you know, whether it's wrongdoing or simple, you know, kind of failure to meet standards. If you're going to be reporting it to the agency or the body or the office that is committing the offense, then you don't have that necessary check on the activity.
Now, if there had been some very obvious reason why Linick should have reasonably been let go, some sort of, you know, abuse of his power, one could understand, maybe Congress might understand Trump's actions, but it seems as though Linick, from the surface at least, without a deep congressional probe, Linick was in the process of investigating the top dog at the State Department, which is State Secretary Mike Pompeo. Initially, we heard that it was over potential abuses of power by Pompeo requiring diplomatic security staff to run his personal errands. Then it came out that he was also being investigated around approving an arms sales to Saudi Arabia against congressional approval, or, you know, Congress had essentially prevented such a sale from taking place, and Pompeo made that or allowed that to go forward, and Linick was looking into that. So that looks all pretty suspicious, right?
Absolutely. It certainly does. And you have some members of Congress who have been asking for what the underlying reasons are, and the answer they've been given has been pretty flippant. You know, that I guess President Trump has said, well, he no longer had my full confidence, but that's certainly not that's not an answer. The question is, well, why did he not have your full confidence? And the concern now is that he didn't have his full confidence because the administration was not certain that Linick would uphold or prevent from accountability one of President Trump's biggest supporters in the cabinet.
In fact, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo openly said that he asked Trump to fire the inspector general. In an interview with the Washington Post, he said, I went to the president and made clear to him that Inspector General Linick wasn't performing a function in a way that we had tried to get him to. Okay, that statement in and of itself sounds bizarre because it doesn't make sense for the state secretary to try to get the inspector general, who's supposed to be overseeing him, to do anything, right?
It sounds like they're saying the quiet part out loud, which is basically just flagrantly admitting that he wouldn't do their bidding, which was he would not abandon his oversight role. The fact that Secretary Pompeo has openly admitted this is remarkable. The question is, will Congress do something about it?
And for him to go to Trump and ask for Linick to be removed and admit all of that, even, you know, this also undercuts any claim that Trump might make about any legitimacy in the firing. So is there any recourse? I mean, of course, President Trump likes to play politics. He pointed out immediately that because it was President Obama who appointed this inspector general, that immediately cast a pall of suspicion and that he had the absolute right to fire inspector general. And, you know, especially, you know, given that Obamagate, all he has to do is throw out this fictitious idea, Obamagate, no matter, you know, the fact that isn't something that exists. And it seems as though he has made it very clear that he wants to turn the role of an inspector general into a partisan role. This is the hallmark of a corrupt government, right?
I would say it is. And I think that this is one of those many examples that we've seen in the last 3 years of norms that we've had in place for a long time that we just assume in, you know, let's say a gentleman's or gentlewoman's agreement would not be violated because it just seems too corrupt. We are allowing these things to happen because, frankly, there isn't a legal reason to prevent Donald Trump from firing the inspectors general. The problem is that we have always assumed that that's such a guilty move, if you have a case such as this where a secretary has asked for the removal of the inspector general, that we just assumed that nobody would go that far. But under this administration, we've realized that these things that you can assume someone might not do under normal circumstances, we can't make those assumptions anymore. So the long-term recourse is that it needs to be legislated, you know, what the standards are and how inspectors general get removed.
So we mentioned this was the fourth in six weeks to be removed. The first one was the ousting of the Intelligence Community Inspector General Michael Atkinson in early April. Tell me about that story. This seems as though this looks like was basically connected to the what ended up being the impeachment trial of President Trump and the impeachment of Trump by the House. Was Atkinson fired as part of the Trump purge over impeachment? He made it very clear, and he was very open about the fact that he was essentially going to fire anybody that he felt encouraged the impeachment trial.
Yes, it was absolutely related to that. And the interesting thing about Atkinson is that Atkinson's role required him legally to hand over the whistleblower report to Congress. It wasn't something that was done for partisan reasons or for political reasons. It wasn't something that was done just out of his own sense that Congress needed to know. He had a legal obligation under the circumstances with that whistleblower report to share it with Congress. So he was fired quite literally for just doing his job. I also want to mention that this is such a fast moving train right now, but that I believe we might actually now be up to the fifth inspector general, because recent news is that the inspector general for the Department of Transportation, I believe, was also just this week sacked as well, although it's so new, I don't even have the details on
why.
But we can expect more of these to come through the pipeline if it doesn't stop.
And then you also had Christy Grimm, Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services, who was removed. HHS has also unfortunately become this department that has been deeply politicized, right, under Secretary Alex Azar, which has come to light during the coronavirus pandemic and some of his actions or inaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and absolutely. That one was related. It came right on the heels of the... I don't even have the order right now, but it came very recently, and it was due to coronavirus issues with the way that response has been managed, because you had officials within HHS who were preparing and in the process of reporting to the Inspector General's Office of HHS on the kind of ham-handed and poor response to the coronavirus pandemic. So those happened very quickly, close together, and we've seen subsequent ones, which shows that it's not about a specific issue. We have issues that are related to management and oversight of funding with coronavirus relief. We have issues of how coronavirus pandemic response has been done. We also have the issues, as you mentioned before, with Atkinson, which were from back in September. This was essentially punishment for back in September when he submitted the whistleblower report to Congress. So these aren't just being done about a single issue. It's an absolutely coordinated attack on oversight.
Which I suggested earlier was possibly a very deliberate plan. That was Elizabeth Shackelford. She was recorded with Sonali Kalatar. Rising Up with Sonali. We'll get you the rest of that feature. Why is Trump purging IGs? And I believe she just added the one to the list that I found really intriguing. This might really break it open in a way, because it involves Elaine Chao, Transportation Secretary and wife of the potentate of the Senate, Mitch McConnell. Apparently, there was some investigating going on about what the Transportation Secretary was doing that may have benefited her overseas Chinese family. I believe that's true. I think I don't know if they're from Singapore originally. They are shipping magnates, so it's kind of a eyebrow raiser to start with, that Elaine Chao is Transportation Secretary. All right, I did promise this, and I'll get to it. You can find the rest of that, Rising Up with Sonali, as she mentions. It's lots of places available. But this is about the jungle, Upton Sinclair. And it starts out with a quote from Upton Sinclair. I mentioned that it hits us kind of close to where we live, because we have this fairly large meatpacking place up at Rantoul Products, I guess, that is implicated perhaps in the spread in this region that puts us fourth in some rate of expansion of cases, along with a lot of other small towns that either probably have prisons or meatpackings or some kind of large factory as a vector for spread. All right, this is well-crafted. It's from the latest Intercepted. I commend the entirety to your attention, but we'll get on what we can in this last 15 minutes. Doug Henwood has a historical piece on the bloodbath in Indonesia. Actually, there was a book by Chomsky partially about that region. that was shredded by the publisher. Chomsky's written so many books, you would expect at least one of them to be actually officially shredded by the publisher under pressure.
It was put down with terrible violence, which was customary in those backward, far-off days. And the strike was completely broken, and the workers went back to conditions which were described as very terrible. And so I decided that I was going to write a book about the Chicago stockyards from the point of view of labor.
Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle, sparked public outrage when it was released in 1906, but not over the plight of meat workers. In response to the conditions that Sinclair detailed, concerns over food safety took center stage, and they brought about the first meat inspection laws to be passed in the United States.
And so it was that in July 1906, a law requiring government control of meat inspection, re-inspection, and supervision of processing and labeling was passed. From that time right up to the present, that law has had a profound effect upon the health and well-being of every American citizen.
Upton Sinclair later wrote, quote, "I aimed for the public's heart and by accident hit it in the stomach." More than 100 years later, jobs in the meatpacking industry remain among the most dangerous in our society. The industry consistently maintains the highest workplace injury rate compared to all other manufacturing and private industry. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And while conditions for workers and wages improved for a period after World War II, decades of deregulation, consolidation, and the shift from cities to rural areas of the country have undermined workers' ability to organize and unionize for better protections and standards. Like many things, this public health crisis, the coronavirus crisis, has heightened the inequities hardwired into our system. As thousands of workers in meatpacking plants across the country test positive for COVID-19, the responsibility to protect workers rests on the prerogative of companies. And again, as in 1906, the action from the government hits in the stomach with demands to keep the processing lines running.
They had a disproportionately high number of people that had the problem, and that's going away. The plants are very, very clean now. They're getting to a level where I think we had a report that they're cleaner than they've ever been. That's a good report, but I don't know exactly what that means, but they are cleaner than they've ever been.
So no interruptions to America's obsession with meat.
There's nothing quite like the taste of beef. A thick, juicy steak.
It's a real American dish. As American as baseball or an ice cream cone. Incidentally, ground beef is probably the most versatile of any meat you can name.
A day of life is getting ready to diminish in the Pacific. There is meat for dinner. Another day of meat for America.
Joining me now to discuss how COVID-19 is affecting workers in the meatpacking industry and the nation's long history of treating workers as expendable is Ted Genovese. His book, The Chain, Farm, Factory, and the Fate of Our Food, was an investigation of Hormel Foods and the effects of increased line speeds on the meatpacking industry. Ted Genovese, thank you so much for joining us on Intercepted.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Just to begin, according to data from the Food and Environmental Network, as of May 18th, at least 214 meatpacking and processed food plants and 11 farms have confirmed cases of COVID-19. At least 2 meatpacking plants and 4 processed food plants are currently closed. Ted, of the more than 16,000 workers testing positive, around 90% are meatpacking workers, and at least 59 of these workers have died. Why are we seeing such a high rate of infection at meatpacking plants around the country, and why have meatpackers become hotspots for COVID-19?
These are incredibly large facilities. They are open air facilities where there's a lot of airflow through the plant. And in fact, very often, because there are refrigerated areas and hot areas, you'll hear the workers describe the inside of the plant as being like wind moving through a canyon. And so there's going to be a kind of perfect environment for an airborne illness to move through that space. And at the same time, you've got people, thousands of people who are crowded in elbow to elbow, working a strenuous job that causes them to breathe heavily. And so when you've got thousands of people crowded in, a lot of exhalations and a lot of the air being recirculated, it's just exactly the environment that a virus needs to be able to spread from one person to the next. There's a simple solution to some of these things in the form of PPE and other sort of protective gear that can be given to workers. I mean, that's the other side of this, is that the response seems to have been extremely slow and often just not adequate on the part of the meatpacking companies themselves as they responded to the crisis unfolding.
On April 28th, Donald Trump issued an executive order under the Defense Production Act declaring it, quote, important that processors of beef, pork, and poultry, meat and poultry, in the food supply chain continue operating and fulfilling orders to ensure a continued supply of protein for Americans.
I should be signing that over the next hour or so, taking the liability, which frees up the entire system, and I fully understand it, not their fault.
How does Trump's executive order affect the ability of workers to demand or achieve safer conditions, better protections, and compensation?
I think a lot of people have this impression that being declared essential is, you know, being held up as a hero, when in fact what it's really saying is that your rights are reduced because you are seen as essential to the operation of the country. And so it is much harder for the workers to not go to work because they have concern of illness. If they have elderly parents or children that they are concerned about passing the virus to, none of those concerns are taken into consideration. There's also a longstanding problem that has to do with the strength of the UFCW, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union that represents meatpacking workers. They're just not always in the best position to be able to negotiate because these companies have gotten so incredibly large. The whole system is built around this idea that the workers are essentially expendable. It was difficult for these companies in some ways to change their mindset. They're so used to thinking of any individual worker as someone who can be readily replaced that they weren't really quite prepared for the possibility of hundreds of them being, or thousands even, being out sick at the same time, or in the case of the workers, just being afraid to go to work. It's a really tense situation on both sides because the workers are clearly not being adequately protected at work. And then on the other side is the nation's food supply and the question of what happens if these lines stop running.
Give a sense of who the people are that are hired to work at these meat facilities.
Meatpacking has been a job that's been performed by immigrant labor really from the beginning of industrial meatpacking. In recent history, that workforce was made up primarily of refugees who were coming in sort of the first wave in the period of deregulation from Vietnam and Southeast Asia. Then as NAFTA was put in place, we saw a large influx of Mexican workers and workers from other parts of Latin America. But that workforce has really, really diversified in recent years. It's now very common in a plant to see workers from Somalia, from Sudan, the Karen workers from Burma. It's not unusual for a plant to see 2 dozen, 3 dozen languages spoken on a single shift. This, again, makes it very difficult for the workers to even communicate with each other about what may be happening when there's an illness spreading. But it really makes it difficult to organize and to try to put together some sort of concerted effort to lobby on their own behalf.
In a piece that you co-wrote with reporter Esther Honig for Mother Jones, the story begins with Crystal Rodriguez, who works with her father at JBS. That's a Brazilian-owned multinational corporation, and in fact, the world's largest meat processor. Her father spent nearly a month in intensive care battling COVID-19. First, tell us about Crystal Rodriguez and her father, Sergio, and how their story compares to other meatpacking workers.
Well, I think it's a fairly typical story. What you have is a family that has really relied on the packing plant as a source of income for decades. It is the job that has put food on the table for the family, but it's also made it possible for the kids to get educations, to go search for other jobs. The thing that is also not atypical is that there will be some member of the family who decides to go into the packing plant as well. The thing that I thought was interesting about what Crystal told us was that the relationship with a company like JBS is always fraught, that while there's this kind of loyalty to the company and gratitude for the income that they provided, there's also this sense of never being valued by the company in the same way that the workers value that work. Crystal, I thought, put it very aptly when she described this as being like a bad ex-boyfriend, someone who you have a hard time getting away from and keep going back to just because you have a lot of history together. I think that's a fairly typical relationship that workers have with these plants.
The JBS plant that Crystal and Sergio worked for in Colorado ended up having a major outbreak with more than 245 workers testing positive. And as of your report that we're talking about, 6 people had died. I'll be curious to see if you have any updates on that. But how did JBS respond to this outbreak? I mean, did they inform their employees that people were testing positive? Did they allow people who may have been exposed to the virus to quarantine?
First of all, that number is up to 7 now that we know of that are confirmed who have died of the virus just in that one plant.
78-year-old Saul Sanchez lost his battle with COVID-19.
They said it was the virus that killed him.
Friends and family say her father was one of the most popular employees inside the JBS meat plant in Greeley.
It appears that the reason that plant was so hard hit was really due to JBS's reluctance to share information with workers and to provide them with what they needed in terms of protective gear, but also just basics like soap and hand sanitizer to keep themselves relatively safe while working within the plant. But the thing that I think is most damning of all is that once it became clear, once there were people from the health department getting involved because they were seeing large numbers of people who worked at the plant showing up at urgent care and at the emergency rooms with respiratory complaints, JBS still resisted testing the workers and doing contact tracing. And worst of all, once they were finally convinced that they needed to do this and even got a guarantee directly from Mike Pence that they would have the tests available to them and make it so that they could test all of the workers,
At this time, our team is working with the governor and working with the senator to ensure that we flow testing resources.
It was reported locally that they started doing the tests on the managers at the plant, and the rates of positive were so high that they stopped doing the testing. And the union has said, look, we think that they just didn't want the workers to know how bad the spread was because they were afraid that the workers who were well wouldn't show up either and that the whole plant would go down.
Once they started testing their supervisors and it became apparent that the numbers were alarmingly high, they abruptly stopped testing without consulting, Wild County. And then they just stopped testing. They never tested any of the frontline production workers.
If the intention is to withhold information in order to put people at risk, there are some really serious questions that these companies have to answer.
How does the response of JBS compare to other meatpacking companies and how they responded to outbreaks or preventing outbreaks?
It seems to be more typical than atypical. JBS and Tyson, which are together the two largest meatpacking companies and control more than a third of all meat production in the country between the two of them, they have both responded very slowly and with a lot of denials. And the thing that I think is most disturbing is to see cases with Tyson where when they couldn't get PPE, and I do believe them when they say that they had difficulty locating PPE for their workers, but they weren't willing to shut down the plant. They weren't willing to go to half speed and spreading people out. And instead, what they did, we've heard from multiple sources, they told people to put hairnets over their faces, which is obviously not going to protect them. In one plant here in Nebraska, at the Tyson plant in Omaha, they told workers that they had a limited amount of PPE available, and so if they wanted it for themselves, they had to buy it from the company. It has all of these echoes to the history of meatpacking, where the workers have always been mistreated and regarded as disposable.
Give us a sense of what it's like to work at this JBS plant, or for that matter, any of these plants, because the stories sound strikingly similar, whether it's Tyson or Smithfield or JBS, but just talk about what it's like to work at one of these plants.
In the 70s and the 80s, everything was about trying to consolidate in order to achieve economies of scale. Thousands of plants got squeezed down to a few hundred.
Facilities which include the most productive beef slaughtering and processing plants in the world.
But what eventually happens is that you can't make the operations any more consolidated, so you have to just make them faster.
The line moves swiftly and rarely stops, and each loin could weigh upwards of 10 to 12 pounds. Further down, workers cut off fat quickly. Off to a different side, others pull sharp knives through large slabs of meat, separating them from the bone.
And that's really been the objective since the 1990s. And so that has, in some cases, meant some automation within the plant, but very often what it means is breaking down complex tasks into simple tasks, making them extremely repetitive, and then making the line run as fast as you possibly can. So what that means in just terms of numbers these days is that a plant like a JBS plant in Colorado may process 5,000 cows in a day. It's not unusual for pork packing plants to process 10 or 11,000 hogs in a shift and may run two shifts in a day. And so everything is aimed at making these tasks as unrelentingly fast as possible. So of course, what that means is that you have both repetitive stress injuries that are really common among the workers, and you have cut injuries that are extremely common also. So even under the best of circumstances, you have a job where the average in the meatpacking industry is that there are two amputations per day. The statistics from the Labor Department tell us that if you work in meatpacking for 5 years, you have a 50-50 chance of sustaining a workplace injury. That's all kind of understood to be the given. So now to layer on top of that, this chance that you may be facing a life-threatening illness as well, I think for many workers, they feel that this is just going too far, that they're suddenly being asked to bear too much of a burden, and especially for what they're paid and what security and benefits they receive.
These stories about the meat processing industry and hearing from workers about the total disregard for their health and the safety conditions within these companies, as well as statements from elected officials.
Once the virus is introduced into this type of an environment, it's very difficult to contain. But these also are essential businesses and an essential workforce. And without them, people's lives and our food supply will be impacted.
You want to talk about some of these protests, that are going on right now? Think about how mad people were when they couldn't get paper products. Think about if they can't get food.
I think remind many people of Upton Sinclair's 1906 novel, The Jungle. Remind people what Sinclair revealed, what he was writing about, the conditions about the U.S. meat processing industry at that time.
Sinclair's goal really was to try to shock readers at the mistreatment of immigrant workers in Chicago's slaughterhouses and by extension in the packing plants across the middle of the country at that time. But what people really zeroed in on were some of the brief passages where there was description of just how tainted the food supply seemed to be. Sinclair was hoping that we would care about the workers, and all the people really ended up caring about was, how safe their food was to eat. This has been a kind of a recurring problem. You know, trying to report these conditions, people are always asking, and you hear it now, is COVID-19 foodborne? Is the fact that these workers are getting sick on the line something that could be transmitted to me through my pork or through my chicken? It shows how quickly we dismiss the concerns about the workers themselves. I always return to what Sinclair sort of famously grumbled, that he had aimed for the public's heart and by accident hit it in the stomach. I think it's important to remember that what Sinclair was really writing about was about the exploitation of immigrants in the packing houses and in the communities that surrounded the packing houses. And he was calling for greater worker unity and for people to push back against these companies. I also think it's worth noting that the slaughterhouse where Jurgis worked in the jungle was based on the Swift packing plant in Chicago at the time. Swift is the company that was eventually bought up by JBS. All of these concerns that were being described by Upton Sinclair in 1906, as you said, these are conditions that still very much exist. And so the question, I think, has to be at what point we start seeing these things as enough of a shared problem that we decide to do something about them. And perhaps a pandemic is that kind of situation.
There's a bit more,